This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and on your pod. In the brave new world of bioethics, is technology threatening to abolish motherhood?
There has always been speculation around replacing the female body from the very earliest writing by Aristotle, for instance, who tended to view the female body as just a vessel for the fetus that was entirely the creation of the male.
That's ahead on the show. That interview with British writer and feminist Louise Perry is coming up. Now, we're keeping an eye on that situation with the huge explosion in Beirut. As of Wednesday afternoon, it looks like an accident or negligence. But if there's any news that affects our area, we'll look at that in a future program. We're going to spend much of today's show in Africa, and we'll start in the north, in Libya, which has become the centre of intense mercenary activity. An investigation by the leading German newsweekly Der Spiegel has found Turkey is paying Syrians and Sudanese fighters to prop up the UN-recognised government. But the United Arab Emirates and Russia are also paying mercenaries to support rebels. The hired guns aren't just prolonging the conflict. They've become major spreaders of the COVID-19 pandemic in northern Africa and the Middle East. Christoph Reuter is one of the Der Spiegel journalists who uncovered the story.
Theatres of conflict where you have a whole variety of mercenaries involved. It's clearly Libya in the first place, second Yemen, and third was Syria, although the hardcore military conflict there is largely over. But the most interesting examples clearly are Libya and Yemen at the moment.
In this climate of pandemic, do we know if these mercenaries are also helping to spread coronavirus?
Oh, absolutely, because they are the perfect super spreaders. They are traveling from place to place, wherever the front line is. Then they go back home, come again. So for Syria, for example, the first cases of corona, COVID-19 cases in regime-held parts of Syria were where you had Iranian commanders, Lebanese Hezbollah fighters, Iraqi fighters, the militias fighting on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. They were the first spreaders because they did exactly the opposite of any quarantine. They moved from Iraq back to Syria. They met with commanders from different countries. So yes, if they are a composition of fighters and commanders from various countries, and if they keep traveling, they are the perfect spreaders.
We've talked about the places where the mercenaries are active, but who are the main players in funding the mercenaries?
You have, let's say, usual suspects as Russia, who since long time has always armed and funded groups to fight on their behalf. But the new thing is that you have countries like the UAE or Saudi Arabia, especially the UAE. We never thought about using warfare, using mercenaries to win a war in a country they don't even have a border with. So for Libya, for example, we have as the biggest sponsor of the eastern Libya camp, UAE, and on the western side, the UN-recognized government, you have Turkey. So you have two Muslim countries which a few years ago had no objection, but suddenly they are at each other's throat, sending in, as the UAE people do, people from Syria, people from Sudan. And the Turks as well sent in people from Syria from their area they are controlling. Yeah? So it gets this medieval flavor of complexity.
Yeah. In Libya, you've got Turkey supporting the Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj, and you've got Russia supporting this rebel leader Haftar. Why are Turkey and Russia so interested in Libya, such that, as you say, they're at each other's throats?
You could start with the simple, let's say, classical explanation. Libya owns giant oil reserves. So it is interesting for Turkey when it comes to mining licenses, drilling licenses. For Russia, on the other side, oil is not the most urgent commodity. And for the UAE, the second big sponsor, there are not a need, an urgent need of more oil. When you dig a bit deeper, you see that you have ideological differences that, for example, Turkey, as well as Sarraj, the Western Libyan government, they are ideologically affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, with a movement that isn't very democratic, but it accepts democracy, it accepts the will of people to topple monarchies, which, of course, for the UAE, they don't want to have an order where the king could be toppled. Mm. Although the UAE is not in danger from Libya itself, but fighting the idea of Muslim Brotherhood in another country where this movement could take over, as in Libya, has become a centerpiece of their political hubris.
If the countries that are backing the mercenaries may be doing it, as you say, for ideological reasons, I got the very strong impression from your extensive article that the mercenaries themselves aren't necessarily ideological. A mercenary, for example, isn't necessarily a jihadi, is he?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the jihadis who joined the so-called Islamic State also fought for money, but they came in the first place because they believed in something. What we have in Libya, or what we had also in Syria before, is that we see a lot of fighters from other countries who came in for the money. The most crazy aspect in Libya is that you have Syrians on both sides of the front line who are well paid compared to the economical disaster at home, or don't have a chance to stand the will of the Turks in the northern part where Turkey controls everything. It's really like in the 30-year war, people fight as a job. They fight to survive, to earn money. They're not too keen on which side they would fight on. Mm. And sometimes even in Libya, they switch if there's a chance, because the Turks pay much better than the UAE and Russia pay. So they are sometimes seem to be willing to be to surrender and to fight for the others for five times more money.
Yeah. I mean, you say, point out that those who are fighting on Russia's behalf are getting about $1,000 a month. Russia also offers them something that would do any unionized German worker proud. Russia, it says, will pay you a month's vacation every quarter.
Yeah, if fighting is becoming a profession, then you want to see your family, you want to bring home the money, because Western Union is not really strong between Eastern Libya and Northern Syria, you have to offer commodities. And it's extremely important for the other side that Turkey, which pays about $2,000 a month, that they really pay, that it's a reliable business, that there is trust, which sounds odd in this gray zone of militias, but people would not fight if they couldn't be sure that, yes, at the end of the month, the money will be paid. And if I'm dead, still, I will get at least 1, 2, 3 months payment for my family.
The problem that you identify with the mercenaries, among many, is that they prolong the conflict. How do mercenaries prolong a conflict?
You have local owners of the conflict, local strongmen, no women in these spheres, who command loyalty among their followers. If these people see that we are the minority, we are weakened, we are tired, we can't fight any longer. So they would give up, or they would be willing to negotiate, and a conflict would end by sheer exhaustion of the parties, or of the one party, but often it's both parties. So if you have the situation where basically each and every ruler, be it Haftar, be it Sarraj, can pick up the phone and call Dubai or call Moscow or call Ankara and say, sorry, but we really, really need more fighters. Otherwise, we lose and all your investment will be gone. Either they get more fighters, more ammunition, more weapons, or at least they continue to fight in the belief that they could always make this crucial call. And when you see how condescending both sides were in this peace conference in Germany last year, where, yes, they came, they showed up, they say, oh, yeah, we love peace, we will negotiate now, and did absolutely nothing of it. You see that both sides feel empowered, emboldened to keep on fighting because they know we have sponsors who don't want to lose, so they will keep supporting us.
Christoph Reuter of the German news weekly Der Spiegel, and this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Mali is one of Africa's hidden gems. Its most famous city, Timbuktu, has entered the lexicon as a mythical place at the end of the earth. It does exist and it's home to one of the world's great music festivals. But the last decade has not been kind to Mali. Now the capital, Bamako, is roiling with unrest 4 months after a disputed election. And with little faith in politicians, the people have turned to their religious leaders to find a settlement. Dr. Kwadwo Aduse-Asante is an expert on Africa. He's based at Edith Cowan University in Perth, and he joined me earlier.
What is actually happening in Bamako has immediate and remote causes. The remote causes had to do with a number of issues, particularly corruption, economic issues, poverty. Mali is one of the 25 poorest countries in the world. Against this backdrop, it's been alleged that the president has acquired a private jet. The immediate cause, though, to the unrest in Bamako at the moment has to do with an election dispute. Recently, they had some parliamentary elections and the results were delayed. The country's Supreme Court overturned the elections, making the country's leader, who is currently the president, to stay in power. And that has not gone down well with people.
If it is a political dispute, why have some of the country's leading religious leaders, a cardinal of the Catholic Church and one of the highest ranking Muslim clerics, essentially been called in to make peace?
There are a number of factors. If it's a political issue, you would expect that ECOWAS, which is the sub-regional body, to intervene. They have tried, but it appears that the opposition doesn't trust ECOWAS because ECOWAS requested that all the 31 parliamentarians whose results were disputed should resign and step down for re-election, but they have refused.
Just to clarify, when we're talking about ECOWAS, that is the Economic Community of West African States.
Correct. That's the body that brings together all the West African states. There are 15 of them. But it appears there is some kind of mistrust. And so the solutions that they have offered haven't been taken by the opposition. And so in such a situation, what people would do is to turn to people that they feel have some kind of social influence and respect, because a lot is happening at the moment. In the last 24 hours, 5 soldiers have been killed. This is on top of just 6 weeks ago where we saw 24 soldiers killed. So there's a lot happening. 11 people have died out of the protest. So the Muslim cleric and the Catholic archbishops are respected personalities who Malians feel they have something to contribute to bringing about peace.
Yeah, well, we should just point out that the Catholic Cardinal Jean Zerbo, and you've also got the chairman of the High Islamic Council, Sharif Ousmane Hadare, they seem to get along very well. Does their relationship, though, mirror religious peace in Mali?
Well, it is quite commendable for such a gesture. In fact, it's something that is quite novel in West Africa, because a lot of times in other countries within the sub-region, what we see is Muslims against Christians and Christians against Muslims. It's been happening many times and over the years. So to see this kind of peaceful gesture from these two leaders is something remarkable. I believe that it will go a long way to bring about peace in Mali, because the Catholic Church has a lot of following in Mali, and the Muslims also have got a lot of following. So bringing these two leaders together is going to go a long way to bring about peace in Mali.
What generally is the religious landscape, as it were, of Mali? Has it been a country of religious harmony?
It's mixed, I would say. There has been some kind of tensions here and there. It's largely an Islamic country, when Christians have got some presence there. But their situation or their relationship has been fostering with kind of tensions here and there, but it hasn't escalated. Every time it's tried to come up, there is some talks and it goes down.
Mali has been subject to a lot of outside interference. Not so long ago, what was the situation in the northern part of Mali, especially around that marvelous city, that historic heritage listed city of Timbuktu?
The issue goes back to 2012, and it's one of the remote reasons for the current unrest. In 2012, there was a coup d'etat in Mali, and what happened was that the military felt that the government was not giving them all the things they needed to fight Islamic insurgents who were really armed. The army actually looked very unprepared. They looked less armed compared to the Tuaregs and all the military insurgents. So what is happening in the north is that there are some armed militias and armed jihadists who have taken control over that place. And it is believed that the government either has something to do with it, which is why it is not providing all the resources the army needs to fight these people. So at the moment, southern Mali looks okay, but the north always is brewing. And when you talk about external influences, the French have tried to do something about it. They succeeded to some extent, but when they realized that they were losing soldiers, they slacked a little bit. So the northern part of Mali is actually brewing, and it's one of the reasons why they feel that the current president must step down so that a new government that will boot out the jihadists in the north will be in place for peace to prevail in Mali.
It's worth pointing out that Timbuktu was, until recently, the home of one of the world's great music festivals, great reggae music, a place where Malians of Christian and Muslim background just mixed so freely. How much is the situation in Mali caught up with this broader conflict across the Sahel, which is that strip of Africa that runs pretty much east to west across many countries, but it's this lawless strip? How much is Mali victim to that?
I would see it as a Malian problem first, and the issue also being that when one country is in trouble, then ECOWAS must do something about it. Over the few years that I've been providing commentary on Africa, what I've seen is that when war breaks out in one country and we have refugees that go to another country, what happens is people actually carry with them the same conflict to their new homes. And so we would think that people are just taking refuge in another country. But by the time you realize, some insurgents also happens in those new settlements. So to some extent, yes, I would agree that when Mali fights, it's because of being a victim to what happens in West Africa. But in this case, because West Africa has improved a lot over the years, but in this case, I will see this particular problem, I will characterize it as a Malian problem, not necessarily a West African problem.
What's the solution to making Mali, like, say, Ghana, which is, I think, where you're from? Ghana, a country that has really settled down, that is really prospering, as I understand. What's the solution to making Mali more like Ghana?
The first is to look at youth employment, because currently nearly 70% of the Malian population are youth. They are all young people. And so if you look at that population, most of them not having jobs, you would think that they feel disillusioned and they feel disappointed by the system. I would think also that the Malian system, that is their system of government, will also need to be looked at, because it appears that it's a winner takes all. And sometimes when people are in opposition and they have no say in government, they feel that they're being bullied by those in power. And so that system has to be looked at in a way that give some kind of voice to the opposition, I would say.
Dr. Kwajo Aduse-Asante of Edith Cowan University, and you're with Andrew West. Finally today, medical science has crashed through many boundaries, even taboos. But is it on the threshold of making something as fundamental as motherhood unnecessary? Scientists in the US have developed a so-called biobag, which they speculate could replace the womb. They've already experimented with a sheep's uterus, removing the lamb by C-section and bringing it to term in the biobag. Could the same technology be used on women? Could they create artificial mothers? It's a question that British writer and feminist Louise Perry raises in a recent piece for the online magazine Unheard. She joined me from London.
I think particularly with the biobag, the intention is to do with protecting premature infants from harm, which I would, you know, absolutely support as an endeavour. But in terms of the long-term effects, I think it's interesting and I think it's worth us thinking carefully about, because we are seeing this technology develop very quickly. And even though we're a long way off actually being able to replace the human body in gestation, I think you will sometimes read news reports, including reports about the biobag, which suggest that any day now we're going to be able to grow babies entirely outside of the human body. And I don't think that's true, because that's a very difficult task and I think we're a long way off. But it's something that we might see on the horizon within maybe the next century or two, rather than the next decade or two. And I think it's something that's worth thinking about very carefully, because of the astonishing social effects. The case that I make in the piece is that at the moment, what we are seeing a lot of is money put into research on these kind of science fiction technology, which gets headlines and is very high status kind of research. And we don't see that same level of attention necessarily paid to associated health problems with pregnancy, which are often very unglamorous, very burdensome to mothers. There doesn't seem to be as much incentive among researchers to develop exciting new technologies to alleviate that kind of suffering.
Is this effectively, Louise, an attempt to abolish motherhood by some people, by some enthusiasts for this technology?
There are some ethicists who would support ectogenesis, so gestation entirely outside of the human body, for feminist reasons, which is a very interesting line of thought, the idea being that pregnancy is dangerous still, even in the modern world, and uncomfortable and painful and very burdensome. And if you could make it possible so that women weren't tasked with doing this necessary task for the continuation of the species, maybe that would be something to aspire to, you know. But then there are all sorts of consequences of that we'd have to think about very carefully. For instance, if it became possible to remove fetus from the mother at 23 weeks or even earlier and put the baby into a biobag or equivalent, think about what effect that might have on abortion legislation. This is something that ethicists are thinking about, because if you justify abortion on the grounds that pregnancy is a burden that we shouldn't force anyone to go through, if that's your argument for abortion, that it's the physical experience of pregnancy, which is an unreasonable expectation on a pregnant woman, it becomes very difficult not to argue that you should just remove the baby, put the baby into a biobag to allow it to gestate to full term. And then the woman who sought out an abortion still becomes a mother. She just doesn't become a mother through pregnancy and childbirth. All these sorts of really interesting questions that I'm not sure if we have answers to at this point.
Yeah, I understand how reproductive technology such as IVF is often motivated by a desire to help couples have a child when they're struggling to conceive. But how much is this new debate, the one about the biobag, the debate about creating a child effectively outside that of a natural mother, how much of this is ideological?
I think that something that is ideological is the optimism that we see in some reporting on it and some writing around it, and the idea that this is just around the corner and within 5-10 years we'll have biobags available. And that, I think, has a long history, which is something I read about in the piece, in that there has always been speculation around replacing the female body. From the very earliest writing by Aristotle, for instance, who tended to view the female body as just a vessel for the fetus that was entirely the creation of the male.
If it is, in some sense, ideological, though, how much of this thinking is futile? Because you talk about the feminist writer Adrienne Rich, who basically said all human life on this planet is born of a woman. I mean, it is simply impossible to create a new human life without a male and a female. And at this point, in all but 11 cases, and they were extraordinary, without a female actually bearing the child.
Yeah, I mean, also bearing in mind that those 11 cases, the intervention there was another living woman's uterus, in all but one case, transplanted into a woman who was of reproductive age. So it's not even quite as radical as it might sound in a way, because it was still, in almost all senses, just traditional gestation, but happened to involve an organ transplant. Adrienne Rich is one of these second wave feminist writers who has thought very deeply about the importance of pregnancy in human society and this fact, right, that absolutely everyone begins life in exactly the same way and that has to include a woman's body. I haven't seen any polling on this. I don't know if anyone's ever done it. How many women actually would want to use a biobag or equivalent? How many would want to be able to basically play the role of a father, right, in providing genetic material but not actually bearing the child? And I don't know how many would want to.
How much of this debate about separating motherhood from an actual woman is about the transgender issue, is about effectively allowing transgender women to call themselves mothers?
Yeah, and this is something I talk about in the piece on artificial mothers, because there has been speculation about the potential to do uterine transplants into trans women to allow trans women to bear children. And then the fetus would have to be removed by cesarean, obviously. I quote a surgeon who's founder of the London Transgender Clinic, who's very, very optimistic about this and thinks that it's just around the corner. I mean, I would say that he has something of a vested interest in suggesting that, because so much of the medical discourse on trans issues is to do with suggesting that male and female bodies are hugely similar, and the idea that there really is no reason why you can't do some quite superficial cosmetic medical interventions and someone will become their preferred sex, which I think is actually runs directly counter to the research as it's developing now outside of trans medical care, which is suggesting that there are actually many more differences between male and female bodies than we had previously realised. It's something that was explored in a very interesting new book by the British feminist Caroline Criado-Perez called Invisible Women, where she talks about the amazing data gap we have with regards to how female bodies are different from male bodies. We might reach the point in the future where men and women are prescribed different drugs, because we know that drugs have very different interactions with female hormones, for instance, than in the male body, and have therefore very different effects. And it's kind of interesting to see these twin discussions. On the one hand, the trans medical care, which would say that actually, you know, bodies are more or less interchangeable. And then on the other, this new medical research, which is showing the exact opposite, that actually women are not just smaller men, women are actually profoundly different on the cellular level.
British writer Louise Perry, and there's a longer version of that discussion at our homepage at the RN website, where you'll also find links to Louise's pieces in Unheard and Quillette. That's the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. Catch us anytime at the ABC Listen app or iTunes. Thanks to Mudita Dias, Marty Peralta and Jerome Commissari. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.